That's why designers found a place here. That's why designers are now well positioned to work in the field of data, is precisely because we are able to understand people and problems and context much better than other disciplines, but just because we are trained on that and other disciplines mm-hmm. are not. So it's not a matter of being better or it's just be trained on that. And we spend a lot of time in training students in user studies, user research, and understanding the context and history and culture, and all of that helps you understanding why a certain person may react in a certain way and another person may react in a totally different way in front of the same visualization. Hi, I'm Paolo Ciuccarelli, and you're listening to Gut Talks, double G, U, double T.
Hi everyone, I'm Maria and welcome to Gut Talks, a podcast brought to you by Gut, WGUTT.com. I enjoy adding value and helping wherever I can, widening my spectrum of thoughts, even if it can sometimes challenge the mainstream. All I ask is to rate the show, leave a review and share it. It's a fantastic way to help other podcast explorers discover our content. Now let's get started. Paolo Ciuccarelli is a communication designer and researcher, professor of design, founder of the Density Design Research Lab, an award-winning laboratory for data visualization and information design at Politecnico di Milano, as well as founding director of the Center for Design at Northeastern University. He's committed to making complex data accessible and engaging, especially for those not traditionally versed in these fields, with a fundamental starting point in education. Paolo's contributions to the field have not gone unnoticed, with numerous award-winning publications and speaking engagements worldwide. We explore Paolo's approach to design and data within context, complexity, interpretation and accessibility, AI and technology, and the future beyond visuals. A special shout out to Gianluca Brignoli, who made the intro. So, here we go.
Paolo, I'm really excited we got this big intro from Gianluca Brignoli, who came on a couple of occasions to Gut Talks.
Thanks, Gianluca.
I was particularly excited about that because it's a great topic we're going to delve into. How did you get into the data visualization information design space? What was the trigger?
Yeah, it's a long journey, actually, because I didn't come at first. It was like, you know, step by step. Everything started with a concept that I learned about actually a long time ago when I was studying architecture. So my background is architecture. And while studying architecture, that's a story that I often tell, but I really got fascinated by the idea of complexity. And it's a concept that I didn't know about. Yes, as a term, but not really what that means. And it's something that I discovered in a course, Politecnico di Milano, when I was studying architecture. And it really changed the way I was perceiving, you know, things around, because this idea that everything, especially social and natural phenomena, are complex by nature, and it's something that you can't escape, wasn't really something I had in mind at that time. But then since then, I started to see things differently with this idea of complexity in mind. And it's something that later I had a chance to bring as a topic for the students once, you know, I became part of the School of Design when it was born at Politecnico di Milano. And then when communication design became available as a program and I had a studio-based course, I decided to challenge students with this idea of complexity. And in that case, specifically with trying to represent, to make this complexity visible and understandable to other people, as I understood complexity when I started through books. And it wasn't easy, you know. I had to read very complex books, you know, complexity brings complexity. And it was difficult, you know, I had to was a struggle. I wasn't particularly happy at that time to read those books, but there was something that I wanted to bring to students. And so we started to play with, I would say, more diagrams and systems representations, the data visualization. I didn't know anything particular about data at that time. But step by step through the workloads of the students, we discovered, because I was already building, you know, the core of the research lab that eventually became density design, So at that time, you know, I started to look at data and to discover data with the students as something that could make those diagrams and more, let's say, alive. You get data, you feed data into the diagram, and then it becomes like alive. It's like having a skeleton and then putting on the skeleton some flesh and blood, and then it becomes real, becomes animated and alive. So that's why I got into data visualization, not because of data, because of this idea, this mission that was, has been always the mission of Density Design, the research lab, to make complexity, we say, visible, accessible, understandable, and manageable, even though we know that it's not manageable entirely, at least. You know, you can orient complex phenomena. That's the best you can aim to. It's like, you know, orienting that behavior in a direction that they think it's appropriate. But that's how I came to that. And so data, I think that has been an advantage. So the fact that I wasn't starting with data, so data was just a means to something, as visualization is also a means to something. So, and the goal is something else, is to make people understand correctly, you know, in the best possible way what's going on, and make them able to make decisions, you know, within that complexity, you know, not reducing too much, because then what happens is that decisions are not effective as they should be. So yeah, that's how it came to data visualization, not through data visualization per se that existed, you know, when I didn't know about it. And then eventually we got in contact with the community of people, especially computer scientists at that time working in data visualization. But we were like, you know, strange species in that space. We designers were not really present in that, and I think we contributed in a way to open a space for design for a different approach to data that was not data driven, but more like human centered, and as we say in design. Yeah, so I stopped because I could go on for a long time, but that's how I came to that.
Well, thank you for this. I think I filled up almost 3/4 of my page. There's a lot to unpack because you're touching on so many points here. But first, do you have this feeling that data visualization is more hype today, especially with broad access to generative AI?
It was a hype a few years ago. It's been a hype. Now I think it's less of a hype, also because other hypes, as usually happens, came. And so this got a little bit, but it's also normal. It's something that wasn't diffused as probably should have been. And so that's the hype. So people realized there was something interesting, useful, and they started to ask for that, sometimes even not knowing exactly what was the purpose and how it could help. But at a certain point, like, you reach a certain level of maturity. And I think we are at that level of maturity that is now kind of taken in a way for granted. So people know that it's useful and should be used. And so it's good in a way because you get more mature questions, you know, and requests. So people are more aware. Not enough. There is a lot of still to learn outside for in terms of what data visualization really is and how can help, especially business people. But it's more mature, the field. So that's okay. Good. It's not a hype. So the demand in the market is a little less sparkling, but it's fine. Now it's more challenging if you are in contact with business doing this, and as I am. And so It's you have to fight a little more for clients, but it's you get more mature requests.
Yeah. And on this note, actually, can you expand a bit on your view and if there is a difference, because on how to approach things, if you want to, let's say, work with a data visualization designer or a data visualization engineer, because there is sort of an overlap. And what I've seen is that, let's say, engineers, let's say, science-driven people want data visualization engineers and not the word design. and designers would want to collaborate more with data visualization designers because they can speak the same language. But there is a big overlap from what I read also in conversations. Can you elaborate on your view and experience on this?
Yeah, I mean, to me, what is the purpose? So what are you searching for? So it's not because you are a designer or an engineer that you should look at engineers or designers is what you want to have. So for certain purposes, the engineering, analytical, scientific approach, it's perfect and it works very well. For other purposes of visualization, doesn't. And that's where design can help. Going a little bit beyond the standard, creating more context for the data that you visualize, engaging non-expert users, for example, that's where you need designers. Whether you are an engineer or a designer yourself, you can't do that only approaching the issue as a technical problem. So you need to have a different approach, and that's where design comes into play. So it's not the who you are, is what you need and what is the purpose of the visualization, the visual interface that you're going to create. Given that, then you assemble a team. I have to say that it's often made of both, you know, the
ideally
designers. Yeah. And or the person that's what we search. For example, when we hire people, we search for hybrid profiles, either is a designer with a strong passion for hands-on and coding, or is an engineer with a good sense of, you know, aesthetics and human-centered research and very close to people needs. And so it's the ideal, as you said, is that you have this kind of double identity in a way as a person, as a designer or engineer, or in a team, for example. That's more often the case. So it's not uncommon nowadays to have, for example, joint appointment, as a colleague of mine at North Eastern University is having, for example, across in these two colleges, actually, design and computer science. Or we have the visual agency, for example, we have people that have both skills or both, you know, identities and can help. Yeah, they specialize usually in one or the other, but I can do both. Actually, then understand both. So these hybrid profiles are very not easy to find, as you say it, but very, very, very useful and very valuable in terms of what it produces at the end.
Actually, this is why I was asking if they're hard to find. I think in my mind, I was told because I had something kind of specific to ask you in that space, because the other thing is, how do you educate customers on that one?
Before educating customers, you need to educate people that are able to do that. So, and honestly, one of the reasons why in 2019 I decided to move to Northeastern University in Boston is because they have a master program in information design and data visualization that doesn't really exist in many other universities, not at that scale, not with those kind of faculty. So in Politecnico di Milano, density design is, I think, still the only place where you can do data visualization and information design. So there is no other course, no other research group doing that. And I think it's a limit, you know, given the importance of data and the importance of making sense of data, the fact that a big university, public university is and very relevant, doesn't have, for example, a program dedicated to that. It might be a challenge for the future, but there should be more, you know, of that. So one of the reasons why it's difficult to find those people is because there are few schools where you can train them. It's growing slowly. It's growing a lot of lines. So there are courses with dozens of thousands of people attending by some of the most, you know, popular designers, information designers and data visualization people, that they do these courses. This usually are very well attended because there is a demand also for training, professional training. So people want to learn more about it. And it's needed because then you can find a job if you do that. But yeah, there is not enough, certainly not in university programs. So there are other organizations and entities try to fill the gap and cover this space that is indeed in need.
So you answered my question, because I heard of Density Labs many years ago in Milan, obviously, and you just said that now I know why you moved, because I was going to ask this. Have you ever thought of just starting your own labs? I don't know, like a licensing or an online school or something like that to spread the word more, because you're talking about hybrid figures.
Yes, in a way, yes. And we did it. For example, you know, Politecnico has a consortium that is for a post-grad education. And we did a couple of years a course that was mostly for professional people, and it went very well. It was fully booked and well attended. But then that was just a matter of time. We couldn't. But this year it's restarting. So Polydesign, that is a consortium of Polytechnic Milano, will do that again. And in Northeastern University, I didn't feel that need, because there is an entire program. And so, you know, there is a lot to do in curricular education, and also probably didn't have the time to think about that. I moved 4 years ago, so still kind of a new context. But and then thinking about the third entity I'm connected with, that is the visual agency, we did in the past some training sessions, for example, just for a company. So you get, you know, some of the line managers, and then you do that. Or now it goes under the label of, let's say, data culture. So there are a lot of data culture initiatives within companies. And in many cases, I would say in the good cases, then you have also data visualization as part of it, because you can't have, let's say, data culture without talking about visualization. That is one of the, I would say, stronger cultural components of the data processes. And so yeah, I thought to that, and I did something in those hybrid spaces, meaning that is in between the academic context and the professional context. But you can do that also as part of the university, and that's something very important. Even in a public university, as Polytechnic, you have this consortium that only does that. You know, it's education is transferred, the knowledge to people that work professionally. And the same at Northeastern University, and then, well, the visual agencies, of course, is more business oriented, but they use also other faculty and professors to do this training. So it's, I think it's this positive mix of academic profiles and business goals.
You said, let's go back to data, because I think now you kind of mentioned it before and now and here. I mean, data is everywhere, but it can mean or have different connotations to different people. So before we delve a little bit deeper, just to set the scene, so that's a big, like, what is data?
Well, that's funny, because I'm running a little module of a course that is about strategic design, so something a little broader. And my four lectures are about data and creativity. And of course, we started by reflecting on what data is. And so that's how I usually start. What I know is especially what data is not. And this is something that isn't still obvious, like, you know, what data is not. That data is not, for example, that objective neutral entity that we were used to think of in the past. It's not obvious that it's a construction, it's a human made object that is intentionally constructed in a certain way and is framed from very different, you know, perspectives, you know, technologically, economically, philosophically. That's what we discussed in my lecture last week, for example, all these frames that data has that you should know, because otherwise you don't know exactly what that means, because a data point has been produced for a certain purpose by someone with certain technologies for certain reasons and with a certain knowledge or ideas or what we call biases nowadays. And nowadays it's more clear, thanks, I would say, to big data first and then algorithms, we discovered how humane are those technologies. And now we are bringing that back to data and so, oh, wow, so data was the same, was exactly as humane as algorithms and artificial intelligence. And but we didn't think about that. So you had also terminology that I think was profoundly wrong. So people talking about digging data or like extracting value. But the value is not there. I mean, it's something that you build intentionally, culturally, technically. So it's something that I would say is an interpretation, the data itself. So you have a phenomenon, you want to try to understand and make decisions and act. You need an approximation because you can't, you know, deal with the phenomenon one-to-one real scale. So you reduce it with the data, but you reduce it in a certain way. And that's your first interpretation of the phenomenon because you're a human being. So you can't be neutral. And so, and then you visualize it. And that's another level, a second level of interpretation. And it's even more effective in certain cases. Or maybe not, because data is the fact is all the interpretations that you do with data are invisible, transparent. You don't see that. People can't, don't have the means. With visual, it's more understandable. So you can, you know, discover some intentions in certain ways of designing visualizations, because you can drift people in very in opposite directions, even just changing the way you represent the data set. But you can guess what was the intention behind if you master a little bit visual languages. But with data, it's difficult. If you don't know about data languages and data processes, it's very difficult. So you can trick and you know, data, and you can even lie, as people say, you know, you can lie with statistics and data, but then people will never realize that, or very, very few people can realize that. A little more with visualization, but in both cases, you can really interpret. And then another, just a last comment on data and visualization is that it doesn't end there. So because you produce your visualization, and then maybe that's what you meant before with your question, then it all goes to the reader. I can have one visualization and put that visualization in front of two different people and get a totally different insight out of it because of the prior knowledge of that person regarding the phenomenon, because of the skills and the competencies that person has. You can really trigger very different insights into different people with the same visualization, or have the same visualization when one person would get the insight and the other one would not. But that doesn't, it's, you know, the visualization is never enough to get an insight. It's in between, I say, that space in between the visualization and the mind and the eyes of the reader. That's where the insight happens, but it needs both. It's not there. It's in that space in between the reader, the analyst, the layperson, and the visualization.
Going back to what you were mentioning before, the context, right? There's always a context around what you're trying to visualize and convey. But yet, you will have different understandings. And this goes, I mean, the prime example, which is not the nicest example in the world, but this is wars, right? You have two different perspectives, two different stories, at least two, I would, and more. And this is at a bigger scale. And I'm talking about mass media kind of information where it's one or the other, and then, or one, but depending on the way you look at it, you would have your answer because you have your preconceptions or whatever. And then if you talk about health data and medical data, how can you talk about both, like make a comparison? I'm just trying to see, like, if you have a project you could explain, just to go to be a bit more tangible.
In the space of health data, you mean, or in general?
It doesn't matter. In general, where you would have different interpretations. Maybe take the most complex project you worked on, and how you manage to communicate, because you spoke about decision making, right? So sometimes the decisions can be costly, but they're just decisions because decisions need to be made.
I mean, projects might be complex for very different reasons. Some of them are complex because of the technological challenge. For example, in one project in Politecnico di Milano, on a certain point, we wanted to visualize all the students, you know, one by one as dots in the screen. And that time was challenging because there weren't very few frameworks that could allow, you know, 44,000 to move, well, dots to move smoothly on the screen. And that's something that, of course, then, you know, as technology advances, then it becomes less of a challenge. Another complexity, another level of complexity for a project comes from the people that you involve, you know, what's the user and how many stakeholders you have. And in that regard, for example, for me, the more complex, the more difficult is always the let's say, the layperson, so the non-expert. That's always difficult because you have to recreate a little bit of context because they will not understand. The more you go far from the source, you know, where data has been produced, the more you have to add knowledge and context that the person doesn't have. That's, to me, brings additional complexity. So the more you are far from the expertise in terms of data analysis, the topic, the domain, the more I need to add, and it's not easy to understand how and what to add. These are two different types of complexity. There are others, like, you know, the types of data that you're managing. And when you talk, for example, about health data, that's really, you know, challenging. I remember recently we started a project that, you know, fortunately didn't come to an end, but because it was a startup, and, you know, with startups, it,
yes,
usually like it's like you bet in a way on your client. And but it was a very interesting challenge because they were performing some novel analysis on people and getting a result that you couldn't have in through traditional or available analysis. And that result was about something very important and very, you know, like life-changing event in the life of a person. And so how do you communicate that result? You know, technically, it's a number. So very simple. But how you communicate such an important data point to a person that after seeing this data will change probably forever, you know, his life, and so we'll see change to the life. But it, so that's something. And so we try always again to be as less reductive as possible. So, for example, it was an index, but we immediately decided to unpack the index and try to explain the different components of that index in making that not looking like yes and no, because actually it wasn't really the case. And it's not that it's, you know, sometimes it seems that you have a threshold, but it's not exactly. So conveying these nuances, this potential spaces of interpretation of a data, I think it's, in that case, was very important. It's not, there is no convention to do that. And you have really to work a lot on studying the user. And, but healthcare in general is a lot about that. You know, data is often represented in a very simplistic way, and it could be misleading. It could be scaring. It could be, it could create false expectations and really hurt people in a way that you shouldn't do. And even the hospital, there are ways of representing data that could be changed, even sound. I'm working nowadays a lot with data sonification, that is translating data into sound, not just visual, but in most of the cases, it's just alarms. And then, you know, something that is just meant to attract your attention, but then it creates maybe anxiety where it's not needed. And in healthcare, that's important. It's definitely one of the most complex areas, and where data might be really simple, but the problem on how to convey this data and how to make people feeling right about that and understanding and not be misled, I think that's not easy at all.
Here we're talking about, it's like information. You need to give people what they need to know. What does it mean, actually? And what it means is, can be different things to different people in different contexts. And they can understand it with visuals, but with sounds. Some are like a trigger, bam, you need to do this now. We need to know this now without looking, just We're talking about experience here, right? As you're moving along or whatever. But the visual is something you will stop and look at and spend more time on before. And maybe the longer you spend time looking at something, the more confused you can get. Even if this message, is this what you're trying to say somehow?
I mean, it's, that's something that happens, but usually if people feel that they can get confused, they don't stop and look, they just go away. But anyway, this going back to healthcare, I think your question is really brings the importance of understanding people and the context back. That's why designers found a place here. That's why designers are now well positioned to work in the field of data, is precisely because we are able to understand people and problems and context much better than other disciplines, but just because we are trained on that and other disciplines are not. So it's not a matter of being better or it's just be trained on that. And we spend a lot of time in training students in user studies, user research, and understanding the context and history and culture and all of that, that helps you understanding why a certain person may react in a certain way and another person may react in a totally different way in front of the same visualization. So that's something that you learn, and something that you apply, and something that you spend a lot of time on. That's difficult to sell to companies, especially the part where you sit, beside the user, and then you observe, and then you try to understand, and then you try to wear their shoes, and you design for them something that makes sense for them in that context at that time, and for the purpose that you both know.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest sell, actually, but the most important one, because if this is not done right, then anything you do and all the investments that would happen after might be just a waste.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't mean that you need to do that all the time. So there is literature. Yeah. So there are studies done. That's what we do, research. We studies and then we publish, and then that certain things work for certain types of people. So you have that. So you can't standardize. That's not that you have to restart all the time. But if you are in front of a new problem, in front of a new audience, in front of a new type of user that is approaching this data for the first time. And I remember when the first platform for trading online were available a long time ago. What they did, the banks, mostly they just opened the visualizations that were available to the professional traders to the users that had no clue about, And we did some studies at the time, and it was clear that, the reaction of a normal person, the owner of a bank account, in front of a trend that is going very fast, high and high, then you get excited, and then it's all green. Then you start behaving in a way that maybe if you knew something about the market and stocks, you would have done the same thing. But the visual was bringing you somewhere. You didn't have the knowledge to really understand that. So you just were looking at the data. So that's something that you need to know. I mean, you need to understand what is the, who is the other on the other side of the visualization. That's the most important.
Yeah, and not always designing for the experts, expecting that everyone will understand it.
The problem is new, the context is new, the user is new, then you can't rely on standards and literature because it's new.
Yeah.
Same now for, AI and all these new things that we have. But still with big data, we don't have the visual means to represent all the features that we as humans produced with big data. We produce big data. It's a different type of material. It's like comparing, normal polymer with composite materials. You can't use the same technologies. You can't use the same. And we represent big data with the same charts that have been invented in the 19th century for very simple statistical tables about import-export in Europe. But they were conceived for maybe a few rows and few columns. And now you have big data lakes like graph databases. And then you still squeeze that into dashboard with very simplistic visualization. Yeah, maybe if you have an expert on the other side, he will infuse all these their knowledge into this dashboard, and then we'll come up with an insight anyway. But if you bring this visualizations to a domain expert, a decision maker, a policy maker, for example, in the case of government, they may know about the topic, but they probably were not able to get all the complexity of the problems, just all the complexity of the data, because big data are complex, and that's good. They are more likely to approximate to the complexity of the phenomenon because they are more complex in nature. But we need also more complex visualizations in nature than the ones that we are using, and that's not happening. So it's happening with data, and that's fine. That's super. But it's not happening with visualization. So I want to see big visualizations as we have big data, and not the same visualization that we were using with, let's say, simple data set. And it's slowly happening, very slowly. But if you see the market of, you know, visualization tools, they are based on the same paradigm that we were using, you know, hundreds of years ago, actually.
The structure is the same, yes. Do you feel that with some of the new generative AI platforms, at least testing things out and would be faster?
It's changing things. I mean, it's obvious nowadays, but it's happening in all fields, and it will happen also in data visualization. So my impression is that before having those big visualizations, I was, you know, claiming about in response to big data, we will probably have a different way of different relationship, a totally different relationship with data. That is, probably brings more text, you know, in the way you see data described, because that's where AI is very powerful. It works very well, pretty well, much better than the visuals and data visualization, especially. There is no tool that I know about that is able to generate autonomously the data visualizations and of the complexity that we need. But if you complement visuals and text, that's where things become interesting. And so then maybe you don't need to see it. It's like another route for getting what I would like to get. That is this level of complexity that is enough to give you a good idea of the phenomenon. So you probably will get that through a different way that is like maybe more narrative, I would say. Like we call that we are trying to develop that both on the research side and the business side. It's like augmented dashboards or augmented business intelligence that where you have text and pictures work together to convey an insight and in reaction to the user that you have on there. So it's like there is a dialogue that is established between the person on one that is using. So this idea of understanding a little bit more the context and the user is in somehow could be embedded into the algorithms that combine in a multimodal interface, meaning text, visual, perhaps sound, as I said. A narration that reflects the insights that you are searching for. So that's, you know, it's very vague because that's what we are researching on nowadays. But and we are trying to develop some first prototypes, but it's working. So some of the first prototypes are about visuals that you produce as a normal, let's say, data visualization operator or information designer. And then the text around and let's say the interpretation of those charts is generated all by a generative AI working on text. And so that's something that can create a different kind of reporting, for example. Or the visual agency created this tool that generates motion graphics based on data automatically. So you just create some rules and template, then you feed data about, let's say, I don't know, 100 of different countries, and then the visualization adapt to this data and then generates 100 of different motion graphics that have the same family feeling, but that react to the data and then produces at the end automatically like different visualizations.
This would take personalization to another level, actually, what you're saying.
Exactly.
I think it can be very abstract to some of the listeners. Actually, what we're talking about, I'll try to wrap this up. I like the idea of augmented visualization, actually. I was having a conversation yesterday with a colleague of mine, and we were talking about data visualization in particular, and he was actually saying we should put some sort of motion to explain what this means, because it's complex. And what you're saying here is having this with voice or sound and visualizations and even later on with AR, VR, not later on, right now, actually. Where do you see this going? Because the goal is, even though what we might be discussing might sound very complex, the idea is to make it very simple and accessible, digestible, understandable, understood, and actionable by whoever is looking at this to make decisions.
I'm a little skeptical about the word simple when it's about complex phenomena. So it might be like a journey made of simple steps or an experience made of simple steps, but all in all, if you want to see complexity, you have to have a complex interface. I mean, then doesn't mean that it's complicated and you can't access it, but you have to provide ways to get into the complexity of the visualization that is reflecting the complexity of the phenomenon. I don't want to sound too much, but for example, you know, you mentioned animation, you mentioned one way is just unfolding that complexity through time. So you enter into a narration that starts from a certain point, and then it's like, you know, navigating the links and the nodes of that gigantic network that is the phenomenon. But you are guided through that, choosing one potential, you know, path out of the many. That's choice. That's a design decision, you know. And then you build a narration and you drive people through that complexity. Might be a long, you know, it's simple because step by step, little by little, you get pieces of information. But in the end, you need to have that level of complexity that is enough to reflect. So it's a trade-off always. It's a very tricky, that's the trade-off that we are constantly managing as designers. It shouldn't be too reductive because otherwise the decision you make is not effective. But it shouldn't be complicated because otherwise you will not look at it at all. And again, the decision will be your gut and not your data driven. So you have to bring, and again, this, I'm always talking about phenomena that are complex in nature. So, but you know, complex in nature means also an organization, like a business. I'm fighting a lot with the typical way that you see people represented in companies, in organizations. So we still, in some cases, use this organizational charts, you know, pyramids, or that's not what an organization is, especially if it's a big organization with the complex dynamics, social dynamics that would happen within a big company, innovative companies, for example. They have processes and relationships that are not reflected at all. So yeah, you can continue using those, but you lose maybe 80% of what's going on and how people really behave within the company. It's a pity. It will make the work of an HR manager much more complicated, and it will probably make decisions losing a lot of the information that is floating around, following path and links and connections that are not represented by those very simple. Yeah, it's an organizational chart. It's very simple. But to me, it's too simple, especially for certain organizations. And there is a trade-off, and that's where we work. It's not everything represented, all the employees, all the relationships they have, all the information that they get and share. But maybe something in between that is not too complicated, but it's not the organizational chart that just says who reports to who.
And that basically it goes back to, what does it mean? It doesn't mean anything. It's like who's labeled how, but then what else happens is missing.
Yeah, if you want to see that, if your purpose is to see, you know, who's reporting to who officially and who is in charge of who and who's responsible for whom, that's fine. But if you want to understand, for example, who's the person that is driving that group and really pushing this organization in a certain direction, who's the person that I need to retain because he's absolutely essential for this organization, you don't see that. Not through the organizational chart, not through the some of the dashboards that I've seen. And you have a lots of data within the company. There are, you know, many constraints because of privacy, and that's great because we don't want to intrude people's lives and make decisions that we know how biases might be relevant. But there are ways to handle this data in a way that's more representative of the complexity. And because then what you want to avoid is, at the end, organizations are made of people. You want to make sure that you don't lose the good ones and that you get good ones from the outside, and or you want to know what you lose if someone, some of them goes out. It's not just that it's an empty cell. It's maybe a hub for an entire network of connections and dynamics and relationships that you, if you don't see them, you don't know them. So
going back to what you were saying earlier, just before that, that led us to this, you kind of alluded to wayfinding somehow through the visualizations, because you were saying you need to take people, let's say, on a journey through a path to uncover and discover along the way. And I'm just trying to put this into a context of physical spaces, you know, wayfinding and so on, but also kind of zooming in, zooming out where it matters the most. And this is part of the, you know, hierarchy. When you want to represent something, you start with the general idea, I guess, and then you go a bit deeper. That could be like an approach. How long would one, I mean, here we're obviously talking about, I mean, this could be physical and digital visualizations in a certain way, or data visualization in a certain sense. How fast or how slow should one, I know that there's no yes and no answer to this question, but isn't the scope somehow to, because if we're mixing this with business decisions, isn't it like, I look at it, I get it, I know what to do next, kind of, versus I want to have a museum-like experience. I see you laughing.
No, I mean, these are kind of two very, you know, far concepts or potential experiences of data.
Yes.
Again, there is something in the middle, or that's, I think, the most important is that you have, you should have different interfaces for different purposes. Mm-hmm. So I'm not against, you know, that's something that I want to be clear on that. So I'm not against the business intelligence dashboard that we have nowadays, because they work, again, perfectly for certain types of decisions and on certain types of levels. And then, as you said, if you want to explore, or you don't have a clear question, or you, that's this more exploratory approach to the data you have and to your organization, for example, that's something that cannot be done with the interfaces that you use to compare quickly to numbers and then say, okay, I need to do that. So that's something that's possible. And there's a long tradition. Tools work pretty well. I don't want to make names, but there are, you know, companies that produce wonderful visual analytics tools, and it's fine. So there is a market and they're growing and there are reasons for that. But it's not all, you know, there are not all the decisions you make in a company, in an organization, are those kinds of decisions. Those other types of decisions deserves other types of interfaces, other types of processing the data, perhaps, and maybe other data that you're not thinking to because you just have those other kinds of interfaces. So visualization has also this role sometimes. If you go into certain routes, then you discover that you may need or may want to have data that you didn't think were useful. So there are plenty of opportunities to produce data. Sometimes you don't do that because it costs money. And if there is no reason, you don't do that. But you don't see the reason because you never tried, you know, to make some, you know, scenarios, for example, and say, okay, what if, or maybe you didn't think really to what you want to see or what you want to know because you were caged on the data you have. That's very, happens very often in the company. But it, sometimes it's not just that you have to produce new data. Sometimes data exists outside. Mm-hmm. Open data, data owned by certain companies. And maybe if you don't start thinking broadly to what is that you want to see, what is the problem, what is, and then you look at which data I need. And then maybe some of them you have it, some others are available outside, maybe free, open access, and maybe some others don't exist, and then you could create them. We worked on some projects like that. That was fantastic. You really can change the way people look at data, but just trying to visualize, you know, making, so what is it you want to see? What is your problem? What is, without thinking about data and the, what you have, or the tools, the visualization tools that you have. Because if you limit yourself to the charts that are available on Excel, depending on the version that you're using, so each year they keep adding some visual patterns, but it's not all that exist. And we can invent other ways of visualizing data if it's needed. I mean, there is a reason, if there is a purpose. And then maybe we create the data that we need in order to get that picture. That's something that is also possible. The more technology becomes available and performative, we can create data. Now is much more common again, thanks to algorithms. Now this idea of creating data, like synthetic data, for example, it's much more common than it could have been in the past. So it's something that makes sense nowadays, but probably could have made sense also in the past to have some sort of synthetic data to perform some, you know, speculative analysis, and then maybe think about having that for real. But visualization is not just an end product. It's sometimes a process that you go through in order to understand, and then can lead to change your perspective on data and what you need.
It's never ending. I mean, because it fluctuates, right? Data changes, comes and goes, and there's more or less you need, and whatever. Just going back to the content, there's so much to unpack here. I mean, I'm finding this hilarious that we're doing this podcast that is audio and video. This is on YouTube as well, but then we're showing absolutely nothing. So just words, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I wasn't prepared for that.
No worries. It's audio primarily, right? So we have to we have to be for everyone. But I'm just, some concepts are so abstract that's why I'm just trying to dig a little deeper so we can. It's for me. I mean, I just find this fascinating, to be honest. I mean, it's one of one for me, people to communicate, right? And then it evolves as we learn more and we want more. There's so much to unpack in what you said, but you mentioned your gut. So my question is, which is obviously the main question I asked everyone on this podcast since I started, it's, what's your relationship with your gut? Because you mentioned decision. You said it's all going to be a gut decision, right? On your gut in your work, but also in your life.
I think it's a good relationship, meaning that I made decisions that I realized were not rational somehow, so they were a little bit more instinctual, and that's what I see when I think to gut. You know, that's, is this instinctual, I would say, opportunism that is so positive, you know, meaning that I tend to follow people or projects or thing that emerge, and that I would say that I'm more like, I don't know how to call that approach, but, you know, following what is emerging rather than, you know, planning 5-10 years ahead. But I think that's also maybe more common for designers to have this very open approach, open eyes, open ears, open mind, and then according to what emerges. And then you look around, you know, you have your tools and methods to look around, to observe, and then you shape things. But whether it's an organization, as a research lab or a research center, as the one that I founded at Northeastern University, it was based on some things that were emerging in all the cases. was not just planning in abstract from, it's a mix of them, but I think the gut prevails in a way on the rational plan more often than not. Might be a limit, but so far it worked. And so, yeah, that's in terms of gut feeling, so to say, and how I make decisions. And because it's very difficult to, you never have the full picture, you never have like the all information you need in order to make decisions. You have to rely a little bit on that in any case. So the more you know.
So you don't visualize or go do some extreme data visualization.
I do. Not data visualization, but that's how I started. You know, I always loved diagrams and schematic representations. And I was doing that for other people when there was a meeting or someone was writing a book. They always asked me in the past to do some of these charts. And it was the time when data visualization wasn't really a thing. So it was like more diagrams, trying to explain concepts. I did the same for density design. I did the same for the Center for Design in Northeast. And there is somewhere a sketch, like a diagram, this reflecting the idea, and then it's a little bit changing. I have somewhere those diagrams. That's, yeah, catching and diagrams were my way of, you know, it's like the bridge between gut and planning and rationalizing. But it's still sketched, you know, it's not final, you know, it's precise, you know, accurate, because it's not totally rational, it comes from gut. And so I love those kinds of representations, and yeah, that's a good way to go through. Is like you think when you draw, and that's, I think, something that depending on the way you express what you think, then your ideas change.
So is this the way you approach any project? What's your process like? Do you start with rough sketches, rough diagrams, and can you take us through like a typical project? And I know there's no clear, like defined, right? It changes according to project, but what's like as an overall, if someone's listening and is like, okay, I have something around data visualization, how can they start?
First, you start from the data. I want to look at the data as less structured as possible. So like, we say raw, but raw data is not a thing. So it's something that I don't like. But anyway, so I want to go to the source and see what data you have, and then start thinking about that, maybe visually, and reflect on what this potentially can become. Yeah. And then by myself, you know, without, of course, people have ideas, but I want to have my ideas on the data. And then after that, you sketch. That's always the next step, sketching potential ways of representing not the data, but the phenomenon or the insight that the person is searching for, the user. And then you start thinking about the technicalities. So which chart, or is a chart that exists, is a library that exists, does it need to be coded from scratch? And then, of course, mixing constraints that you have, time, resources. Then you go on different directions. But first of all, I want to see what I would like to have, if possible, and then see how we can get there. Because there are more ways and possibilities to do something that doesn't exist yet than we had in the past. So before discarding something that doesn't seem to be available, I try to sketch it at least, and then let's see what we can do.
And I assume, obviously, the first step is you try to understand the context, right? And who's going to be involved. So as I mentioned before.
Okay. Absolutely.
So you said you try to understand what do you want to get out of it. And going back to Simon Sinek, start with why. Does the why come after?
No. No, of course, but that's, yeah, I've come to even before what we said, you know, earlier. So I was talking about the, let's say, the process.
After, you know, all that. Okay.
after you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's even after you understand the context and context and why. So what is the purpose in that? And that's
okay.
Purpose contains why to me. It's not just a goal. The function is broader. So in the purpose for me, there is the why. And then after that, you start your process. Sometimes you just stop at the why because maybe it's not something that is worth.
Exactly.
Doing. So,
yeah. No, I wanted to highlight this actually. So it's this good, like you're mentioning just in case. So it's not kind of misinterpreted after in any case, because obviously as designers also, you know, it starts with why. And as you said, exactly, like sometimes you can stop after the why as well.
Yeah. And I think there is a colleague of mine says designers nowadays, before designing the thing, they should reflect on what are the things that deserves to be designed, because not everything deserves to be designed or should be designed.
Mm-hmm.
So let's first reflect, let's say, on the why, and then, because, and the same for data, you know, sometimes certain data shouldn't be visualized, shouldn't be represented, and maybe better not to show something, not because you have it, you need to see it or you need to visualize it to make it available. So that goes a little bit to the why. And I think it's also an area where we can say something as designers, because it's not a technical problem. You know, it goes more like on a philosophical level, but that's where sometimes you can make the good decisions, you know, before even starting the process.
Again, so much based on what you were saying. So you mentioned data, and obviously we can get, there is data that you don't need, because in some contexts, some people can be just overwhelmed with lots of data. They don't know what to do with it. That's one thing. And going back to the raw data, you said it's something you don't like. So can you expand on this?
Simply because what we said at the beginning, so because data is never a raw, it's not something that pre-exists. You create it. So it's not like raw food exists. It's not you. It's something that you fish or you, it's there, and then you get it and then you cook. But then with data, you intentionally decide to create data. So it's not something, for you might be given because it's something, but it's not given in principle in the first place. It's something that has been constructed by someone. And that's something that you need to know in order to understand what you have in your hands. When we train students, the product designers, we teach them how to look at wood and recognize what kind of wood it is and where it comes from and how you can process it and if it's good or not. And certain companies nowadays, they don't work with certain type of woods because it's not good, you know, for the planet. So you need to know that, and you need to know what kind of processes data went through before they get to your hands. So that's what I mean by not thinking as less as possible today. There's something that is raw. It's not raw, or most of the cases is already cooked to a certain extent.
I will try to visualize this. If we talk about generative AI platforms, right? You have pictures that before training, you have the pictures. Same here for the text. Before training the models, you have the words and the text. Going back to what you're saying, the raw material, right? Is this what you mean? Because if we get another, not generative AI stuff, we talk about wearables. I don't know, Apple Watch, right? Let's say smartwatches or Oura Ring or whatever. We are collecting data as we are moving. We don't have access to it, I guess, as raw data. For me, raw data is like an Excel sheet file full of numbers, something like that. So can you explain what you mean by that, and if this is making sense?
Yeah, I mean, if you think, for example, to the Excel table, that's not raw data to me. You know, it's something that has a structure already. So you have to make decisions on the columns and the rows, you know, and you are structuring the data set in a certain way intentionally or maybe unconsciously, but you are doing that. The moment you put data within a table, now we can, someone says that table is the first home of data visualizations. It's already a visualization, a representation of the data. So that's not raw data. For me, it's already an interpretation because you have to make decisions in order to feel those cells in a certain way. You can feel the cells in many different ways.
So it's like a puzzle that is completely deconstructed. This is raw data for you or not even that?
No, not even. Because a puzzle is already, you know, there is a one way to put pieces together. So you can't really do much more than what was already planned.
Legos.
Legos a little better.
Okay.
Little better because there are
different options. Yeah.
But then you can play with them in a different way. With a puzzle, it's much more difficult. So yeah, Lego is a little more raw than puzzles. But again, it's more like that I want people to see, recognize that this table is already driving you in a certain direction. So if you put certain data in columns or, you know, you can make decisions that really drive the perception of data in different directions or with the table, not even with the visualization. We are in the kitchen already, so to say. So it's not, so the data is the one that is, for example, the most raw data I can imagine. As you say, you know, you have a sensor. The closer you get to the sensor, the closer you get to the raw data. So there is a sensor, but then itself, you need to know which sensor it is. What is the level of accuracy? How does it measure, detect, you know, the signal that is biological, natural, whatever, and then transform that into a digital entity? So how does that work? Nobody knows, but there are different ways to do that, of course, and might be done in different ways for different reasons. So that moment the sensor worked, that's, you create the first data, but then how this goes to the surface of your iWatch, yeah. Then there is another lots of decisions over there, and then you see data like circles or whatever, and then this is another, that's all cooked. You know, there are tons of people working on deciding how to move data from the sensors to the screen and create that visualization that became iconic, but was just one of the many potential ways to do that. And it goes away from, you know, the trend lines and bar charts that we used to have. That's fine. It works. And, but it's certainly, I mean, that's just to try to be a little bit more concrete on what raw data means and what is not.
So if I understand correctly, raw data doesn't exist because it is not tangible, even visually tangible, at all. Because as soon as it's got a sense of meaning or direction, not even meaning direction, it means that it's no longer raw. So the raw data, you don't see it, you don't perceive it, you don't feel it, like you don't come close to it.
Yeah, no, normally you don't. You're right. To me, I mean, that's my opinion.
Is it the same for LLMs?
Oh, that's maybe a question that goes beyond my knowledge about those technologies. I can't say if it applies in the same way. I need to think about that. That's a good question, and but I don't feel comfortable in answering.
Yeah,
you're like, you know, I can't pretend to know it. So
yeah, so your work is more with, you know, data before generative AI in that sense.
I mean, we, as I said, we use generative AI as part of, let's say, visualization projects.
Yes.
We don't work on generative AI.
Yes.
So
okay.
We don't develop novel algorithms. We use them as we use other technologies. So we know. And we question data visualization processes because that's where we work. So I want to see, you know, but we don't work much with AI per se. So there are people working on explainable AI, for example, through visualization, and they know, of course, much more than I do in terms of, because they work on that. They produce visualizations that help experts, like people that design and runs algorithms, to understand what's going on. And so they need to know what happens. Mm-hmm. So maybe they know they have the answer that I don't have, but I'm more on using AI than working for it.
So going back to raw data, doesn't exist between like brackets in that sense. Well, let's look at the industry in general. What's the language around data visualization, raw data, information, whatever? Is there a common ground around this? Because I know like that, for example, raw data is used in, I mean, you know that as well, right? It's something used much for you. It's not what it should be called. But around the language, sometimes some words can actually create misinterpretations or misunderstandings. So what's your experience with this?
No, that's exactly why I don't like it, because it's a term that may create the false expectations or may drive people, and that's what it does often, to think that is a data is just a data that doesn't have frames, that is not potentially biased. But the moment you realize that it might be biased, then that's where you realize that raw is wrong. Because if it's biased just because it's not raw, it doesn't exist. It doesn't pre-exist a process that has been intentionally put in place in order to create it. So that's precisely because it's a misleading terminology. So there is a wonderful book that I like. It's 10 years ago, 2013. And the title is Raw Data is an Oxymoron. And I'm totally in with that idea. So if you want to know more about this, why raw data is not good, I mean, of course, it works as language does. You know, sometimes you use words that are not 100% appropriate, but it helps in making people understanding each other and talk. But there are many other words that are like used, and or even the metaphors that you use for data, like, you know, journalists, they say data is the new oil, data is the new gold. Yeah, they have some similarities with oil, but if you think then deeper, then there is also something very different between oil and data. And same for gold. It's true that certain data, especially now, can be very precious, and the scarcity in data is very different. It's not precious in the same way, but of course, it's language, it's metaphors. He helps in just making people understand. But then when you understand a little bit, then you maybe go and learn a little bit deeper what is the real meaning of things.
Is this a common understanding around, let's say, the design community as a whole? Of course, you would have exceptions, but because if you were to talk to, let's say, data analysts, data scientists, and people who want to use what I'm going to call raw data, that is not raw, how would you call this?
I don't think there is a need of this discussion. Okay. In certain contexts, you don't need really to go, because the moment you realize that you are, if you are talking with an analyst in front of a business analysis tool, then many of the questions and reflections have been made. So that tool embeds in a way the answers or the idea of data that you have. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, if the purpose is just to make that process, decision, analytical process a little better, more effective, more efficient, you don't have to question the nature of data. But then if you see that there is a problem, that they don't know what the problem is, that what they see doesn't really represent what they want to see, and that if the problem becomes a little less technical and more like, that's where you missed. But are we looking at the right data? Are we looking at the data right, you know, in the right way?
Sure.
And then maybe you start questioning a little bit what is behind. But in some cases, it's just not the case. And it's generally something that I say to anybody I talk with in general when I train people. But it's not as, in some cases, it's just not good as a, appropriate as a discussion to have, because I've been already discussed, you know, in a way, and embedded into some practices or tools that are used.
I mean, that's the toughest one anyway, not just, I guess, in data visualization, but in any, there's not going to be one way. And this is nice because you get discussions, really. We spent like maybe 20 minutes on that one. So in that case, I want to go back to the fact that there is data, but sometimes you don't need to get additional data. Sometimes it already exists and you have it somewhere. What's your experience actually with data transparency and trust around it? Because this is big. I mean, once I have a story, I was with like a startup and they were like saying, yeah, we're getting data and just plugging it in and then just creating whatever they were going to create. I'm not going to go into details on air on that one. And then I just had one question, like, where are you getting the data from? And do you trust it? And people, are they going to trust it? I said, I don't know. I'm like, what? And this is going back to not just why, but how. And after the how, you should stop. Not because this is the key thing. So what's your experience around this?
I mean, that's very often people don't question data. And that's true. I mean, it's not your case. But again, it comes to this idea that it's that the data exists. And so it's there.
Anything would do.
There, and then it's fine, but it's not. And honestly, in certain cases, it's difficult to understand who created that data set and why and how. That's something that often is not available as an information. Mm-hmm. But that's something that happened in other domains. That's what regulations did, or that's what laws or countries decided to treat certain materials or certain semi-finished products in certain ways, and to track, to produce information about them. When you buy like a slice of beef, you in certain places, in your countries, everything, you know, what is the food that they used to grow the cow, and how the cow's been, where and when and how it's been then processed, and then how it came to you, and what is the it contains. So you track everything, you know everything about it. That's fine. Then you make a decision that, okay, I use it. But we know many cases, we know nothing about that. There is work done, but of course, the problem is that we are surrounded, overwhelmed by data sets all around. So it's a lot of work to make sure that you have good data. But that's why they are precious. As I said, you know, now preciousness is maybe more a thing than it was before. So there was this call I saw recently by OpenAI calling, do you have a good data set? We need good data sets in order to train our algorithms. So yeah, data quality is a thing. It's important, it's relevant, it's difficult, but it's worth it. So that's something that is going to grow, I guess, and hopefully, and even for business purposes.
I have a question here, and we're talking about traceability in that sense. So do you think that we're going to see more data sets and processes and so on the blockchain?
Well, that's another topic I feel not really 100% competent. Anyway, something that has been a hype in a way. Then I saw lots of visualizations of what was going on in the blockchain, but then like a little bit, they kind of disappeared. And I don't know exactly what is the status of this area and how much is produced. My impression is that it went so far that it's kind of impossible to track and to describe. It really exploded in many different directions, so with many different blockchains created and then disappeared. You know, every company that was created, they created their own blockchain. And so it's not many. Now I think there are few that remained, but again, it's not something that I know much
But you touched on something actually important that reminded me of something I was discussing with a company once. They were doing really well and they had lots of data, but they were working in the kind of emergency field, like to support people and so on. So there was part of it that was completely on the blockchain, completely transparent, whatever. But the other part where the question was, how do you actually know that, let's say, X got affected or whatever? But that was really done manually. So for me, it kind of doesn't support, if you want, the mission. And because this is where lots of corruption can come into play, right? In a way, should not go into this topic. This is why I'm just asking about not the visualizations, but the backend of where is the source and how can we make this clear? And we're confident also that this is transparent and can't be tampered with. I don't know if you do this kind of research in your lab, but actually just to ask you, because you mentioned data and sounds, VR and AR as well. Are you playing around this whole playground? Because there are lots of experiences that can be done through visualizations in that space.
Yeah, I'm a little skeptical about VR because of the interfaces. I think it's still too invasive, and I don't think something worth, in a way, investing time as it is at the moment.
Yeah.
AR is much more interesting for data visualization because there are clearly certain situations or contexts where you need to have that device and to know something that concerns that the thing that you're working on. For example, whether it's like a surgical room, or whether it's a factory plant, or you're working on a machine, it's maintenance, whatever. So there are situations where you have your hands busy and then you need to know things and to know that in that moment. And so that's why you may accept to wear something and that enhance your capacities in professionally, usually. But other than that, but you still see the context, you know, the real world. This total immersion into virtual spaces is something that I don't fully understand in terms of potential. And so I'm not able to see with those kinds of interfaces, those devices that we have. I don't know, but just maybe my limit. While I'm open to invest time and resources in AR, I'm not as open with VR.
Yeah, I think it's the opinion of many as well, because they are somehow invasive anyway. So I have a few questions here. I'm looking, so whoever is listening, there is a visualization behind you of some sort. I can't really see. I just see pink and blue and something on the table. But what's your view on static visualizations in terms of printing or even on screens, interactive ones? But then next level, real time, I'm going to throw back that one in. If you believe in real time, just like raw data.
Static printed visualizations still exist. It's something that is demanded. And if I think to the visual agents, for example, most of the, I would say the majority of the revenues still come from static products like reports, for example, or things that eventually printed on paper, or, you know, PDFs, like those kinds of things are still very diffused. That's fine, you know, in certain cases, for certain usages, it's, you know, paper as an interface, it's fine, it works. So why not? I mean, and there are ways to make, let's say, visualizations on paper more interactive, dynamic, so to say, playing with hierarchy and the way you display information, use the space and the way you use the pages, for example. So it's not completely static. You can make that more dynamic and even interactive if you want. So that's my take on paper printed visualizations. They exist. They are good, again, for certain purposes. And interaction, of course, it adds and it helps, for example, as I say, to unfold, for example, complex visualizations through time, space. You navigate, you drill down, you zoom in, zoom out. So all these features help you maybe presenting something more complex than what you could present on paper. So that's something that I like. But then again, it's not always the case, and it's not always worth or needed. There are studies that say that in certain contexts, people just don't interact. They don't want to interact with things. They don't. So it's something that is not necessarily, even if it's good, maybe because you want to say something more complex, but if the context is not right, the user is not the right one, then they don't interact, so they don't see that complexity. So they stick on they just see the first page, so to say. So that's for interaction. I like it because of it helps conveying more complexity, but it's, you know, of course, you may have to understand it, the context and the situation is appropriate for presenting something interactive and dynamic. And then there was a third.
Real time.
Real time.
What do you think about real time? Is real time real? Can you see? Can you perceive? Because it can be so fast that, I mean, what's your view on that?
No, I mean, one may say that real time is never real entirely. You know, there is a certain lag or delay that often exists. So, but then the choice is whether real time is really needed. So I've been involved in projects where we had real time data to play with. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really mean anything to the user. So there are cases where you having a snapshot every day, or let's say every hour, is more than enough. And yeah, having more frequent snapshot doesn't mean anything, or maybe even misleading, but because maybe you see that and then you know that given the phenomenon, something will happen. Real time is an opportunity sometimes, but it's not always useful. The fact that you have real time data doesn't mean that you have to represent them real time. That's maybe simple, but is what I always think. Because is it worth? Because if it's not worth, then you choose the easiest for the user. Maybe once every 30 minutes is enough. So let's do that.
Real time can be sexy sometimes and the selling points. That's why.
Can.
In what context, did you feel that it wasn't?
More than sexy, I would say seductive, meaning that seductive is something that is driving you somewhere, is maybe doing something not necessarily good for you. That is, I was thinking, for example, financial data, you know, stock markets. You know, all you see, all this constantly changing. Mm-hmm. Of course, if you do speculative trading and you high frequency trading, that's where high frequency visualization is needed. But if you are, how they call them, like, you know, the retail, normal person owning certain stocks, and theory says that you should think way beyond the frame of even, you know, 5 years, maybe that's your time frame. So why should you look at, it's even maybe driving you do things that you shouldn't be doing as a owner of stock, little share of stocks in for a company. So in some cases, it could be really even misleading and sexy, but in a way that lead you do things that it's better you don't do, but because it's not, shouldn't be your goal. So in that case, you have real, close to absolute real-time data, because even there is a milliseconds of, that's, they fight for the milliseconds in a high frequency trading. But then if you trade professionally and you do that, you know, for speculation, you want to see that. But if you're a normal bank account owner or trader, like amateur, you shouldn't be looking at those real time data.
I have to find a way of asking this question. I'm with it here. And that goes back to the beginning of the conversation. So with generative AI, will there be more or less need for data visualization? Because you mentioned text before, right? There will be more and more text. So the question is, if you have less, if you would have less over time with the prominence of generative AI, would you still need data visualization? And this is not like data visualization is dying. What's the next for data visualization in that sense? Because it evolves, right? It grows.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, I think, a very good question. I think a very good way to end this conversation. I think it's not the point is not whether visualization, you have less or more visualization. I mean, what is certain is that you will have different ways of representing data, and these ways will be not only visual. So data visualization will be less and less sufficient in a way to the purpose, and will be complemented by other modalities, being those other modes of representation as sound, for example, as I mentioned, or voice or text. Or being like systems, generative systems that complement all these other languages. And so it's changing, certainly changing. We will have more of data representations because we will have more data and more opportunities to create a dialogue with the data through AI, for example, AI assistants. So opportunities, occasions to interact with data will increase. And so you need to represent this data somehow. What you will see is less of the data visualization that we're familiar with nowadays. So that's the less. But in the total, I think, is more, but it's different and includes, and that's my current research direction, the integration of different modalities of to represent data more, let's say, holistically. And that brings also a little bit more complexity, and I'm happy about that.
Yeah, going back to complexity. So that's like the future of data visualization, if it's going to be different because of Gen AI. So thank you very much for this, Paolo.
Lovely conversation. I always like talking about that, and your questions really made me, you know, talk about things that I like to talk.
Okay.
Thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. Your feedback is incredibly important to us, so please consider rating the show or leaving a review. To gain more insights, visit our website at ggutt.com. See you next time.